This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Friday, August the 14th, 2026. As always, we're going to start in the world section of today's Monitor, and we'll go through as many articles and sections as we can in the time that we have together. So, to get us started, our first headline from the world section of today's Monitor reads, Brazilians weigh the benefits of AI facial recognition against the costs. Advocates say smart cameras can help bring down crime, a top priority for many Brazilians. But this technology is exploding before a clear legal framework has been put into place. The date on this article is August the 13th. It is by Constance Mallaret, who is a contributor at the Monitor, and the dateline is Rio de Janeiro. In a downtown office building near Rio de Janeiro's famous Sambódromo Avenue, a dozen police officers sit behind desks staring up at a large bank of computer monitors. Mugshots, camera footage, and interactive maps blink from the screens. This is Rio's Integrated Command and Control Center, or CICC, the State Security Force's technological nerve center. Facial recognition cameras operated by the military police are a key part of this infrastructure. Using artificial intelligence, smart cameras scan the biometric data of passerbys against a database of outstanding arrest warrants. Officers at the CICC are alerted if there's a match and send the closest patrol to conduct a stop. Fear of crime that for many outweighs concerns for data privacy has made Brazil fertile ground for the mass adoption of these kinds of surveillance technologies. There are more than 560 projects using facial recognition technology across the country, more than double the number in use 2 years ago, according to civil society organization Opanoptic. The majority are run for public security purposes by local governments or police forces, but they're also implemented in some private spaces, such as schools. While advocates say smart cameras can help bring down crime, the explosion of this technology without a clear legal framework raises questions about oversight, privacy, and who suffers the most when AI gets things wrong. It's a public policy that has widespread support, says Thalita Lima, research coordinator at Opanoptico. Public security is a problem, and technology is presented as a supposedly quick solution. The Brazilian experience stands in contrast to Europe, where the European Union's Artificial Intelligence Act specifically prohibits the use of real-time biometric surveillance of publicly accessible spaces in most cases. The untargeted scraping of facial images from the Internet or CCTV footage is also prohibited in Europe. In the United States, the growing use of facial recognition by local police and federal agents has become controversial amid increasing reports of wrongful arrests, the technology's use to identify protesters, and a substantial body of evidence that shows facial recognition tools frequently misidentify dark-skinned people. Rio's state-run military police currently has 330 street cameras using Russian facial recognition software. And Tech Lab's fine face, says Major Agdan Miranda Fernandez, who heads the department's Infrastructure and Technology Division. A further 1,300 cameras attached to police cars were deployed in recent months using Chinese company Dahu's software to scan faces and license plates. And Major Fernandez says there are plans
to... The time is 7:17 a.m.
And Major Fernandez says there is a plan to deploy the technology to body-worn cameras later this year. In total, thanks to partnerships that range from cities to private security companies to condominium associations, the force has access to images from around 70,000 cameras. That footage can be run through the military police facial recognition algorithm. It's like an episode of Black Mirror, says Antonio Marcos, a sales representative in Rio, referring to the British sci-fi television series. He says the idea of being watched all the time makes him uncomfortable. But as someone who has cameras at home, Mr. Marcos adds that he does believe surveillance helps improve security. Some 40% of Brazilians say they have been the victim of a crime, including theft or fraud, within the past year. In Rio, the government says facial recognition has played a part in some 950 arrests by the military police since the technology was rolled out in 2024. That's about 10% of the total arrests recorded during this period, Major Fernandez says. Overall, there is one arrest made for every two police stops when facial recognition is used, compared with one for every 506 stops otherwise, he says. It's incredibly efficient, but the police's own data shows that more than half the arrests carried out with the aid of facial recognition were for failure to pay child support, a situation that can lead to imprisonment under Brazilian law, but is not a direct threat to public safety. Surveys commissioned by the city of São Paulo have shown support upwards of 90% for its Smart Sampa surveillance system during big events such as Carnival. Senator Flavio Bolsonaro, who seeks to present himself as the tough-on-crime candidate in the October presidential election, said he would implement a nationwide network of facial recognition cameras if he wins top office. Mr. Bolsonaro is the son of former President Jair Bolsonaro. While the AI programs are being trained to avoid human error, they can make mistakes with very real impact for victims. We know facial recognition carries an algorithmic bias of racial discrimination, says Emerson Beta, a lawyer at Rio de Janeiro's Public Defender's Office. In Sao Paulo, a man who was wrongly stopped five times in nearly as many months after being mistaken for someone who shares his name, argues that the city's surveillance system is biased against black men. Police also rely on outdated databases from judicial authorities, which means individuals can end up in police custody for expired or revoked arrest warrants. Major Fernandez says they take precautions to avoid these pitfalls. That includes seeking out the best possible algorithm. The military police require the software it contracts be evaluated by the United States National Institute of Standards and Technology, considered the gold standard, to implementing a three-step protocol between receiving a facial recognition alert and performing an arrest. But there is always room for improvement, says Mr. Beta. Even well-structured protocols on paper can fall short in practice, he says. There are also concerns over transparency and how Brazil's facial recognition programs collect, share, and store data. Data privacy in public security is not being talked about at the policy level. Ms. Lima of O Panoptico says, there's a very serious privacy issue with the growing integration between private cameras and public cameras without clear legislation on how the shared data should be managed. Brazil has a strong data protection law, but it provides specific exemptions for public security. A bill currently under discussion in the lower house of Congress would allow widespread use of facial recognition cameras by public transport companies, but it doesn't include guidelines on how to store and protect the data. A bill regulating AI, modeled on the EU's AI Act and designating facial recognition technology as an excessive risk, is stuck in Brazil's Congress. Lawmakers influenced by opposing interest groups have failed to reach a consensus. Implementing technology like this is about calculating the trade-off, says Mr. Beta, the lawyer. That means looking at whether the technology is effective enough to justify interrupting someone's right to move freely and their right to privacy. On the latter point, Natalia Quiroz, a marketing coordinator from Sao Paulo, says she feels that ship has sailed. She gave up her personal data long ago. It's kind of out of my control, and if my data can be used for a greater good to reduce criminality, then let it be used, she said. And again, this particular article is by Constance Malloret, who is a contributor at The Monitor. Continuing on to our second headline from the world section of today's Monitor, this one reads, Why Former Soviet States Now Challenge Russia Over Ukraine War. Former Soviet states in Central Asia are questioning Russia's war with Ukraine. The date on this article is August the 13th. It is by Fred Weir, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Moscow. For more than a century, Kazakhstan was ruled from Moscow, first under the Russian Empire and later the Soviet Union. Even decades after independence, it still hardly ever challenges its powerful northern neighbor. Until now. At a regional cooperation forum last month, Kazakhstan President Kasym Jomart Tokayev appealed directly to Russian President Vladimir Putin to end Russia's 4.5-year war with Ukraine. Appearing to depart from scripted public remarks, he declared that the reasons for the war are not clear to many, including us. He went on to suggest that perhaps it's time to freeze this conflict. While Mr. Putin looked visibly annoyed and dismissed the idea, the rare public dissent illustrated a changing balance between Russia and post-Soviet Central Asia. Once dismissed as periphery states by Russia, they are gaining more of a say based on geopolitical and economic realignment. Kazakhstan, the largest landlocked country in the world, might feel empowered enough to speak plainly to Mr. Putin because of Russia's deepening economic dependence on Central Asia. The costs of the war are also threatening its own oil exports. Kazakhstan's main oil terminal on the Black Sea, which is at the Russian port of Novorossiysk, some 540 miles from Kazakhstan's border, has had to close several times because of Ukrainian drone strikes on tankers, though Ukraine has now reportedly agreed to stop targeting non-Russian tankers. Oil exports make up about 35% of Kazakhstan's gross domestic product. Kazakhstan is feeling the cost of this ongoing war, and that's likely the main reason he spoke out now, says Grigory Mikhailov, a Central Asia specialist who edits a newsletter on the region's economy. We don't know the extent of the damages, but it's likely to be hundreds of millions of dollars already. It illustrates the growing complexities affecting Moscow's relations with some of its closest partners, especially Kazakhstan, the largest and richest of the five former Soviet republics of Central Asia. The mainly Muslim and largely Turkic-speaking region was part of the Russian Empire and the USSR until the Soviet collapse in 1991, but since independence also looks toward China and the West. While some of the new states have partially reduced their former dependence on Russia, Kazakhstan remains a core member of all three key Russian-led alliances created to keep former Soviet republics in Moscow's orbit. Almost all of the nine countries that now form one of them, the Commonwealth of Independent States, oppose Russia's war with Ukraine. Only Belarus has backed the conflict. Some, such as Armenia and Moldova, have even expressed support for Ukraine. Most, however, have tried to maintain a delicate balancing act by declaring neutrality while also enforcing some Western-imposed sanctions against Russia and continuing warm political and profitable economic relations with Moscow. Kazakhstan has played a key role helping Russia sidestep sanctions and channel investment from abroad. Mr. Tokayev's departure from protocol was limited, and he subsequently stressed his allegiance to Moscow. But Andrei Suzdalstev, an independent Moscow-based political expert, suggests that the Kazakh leader was probably speaking for many in the region. No CIS member has shown any enthusiasm for the war, he says. It's clear that Tokayev is not alone. The same questions are being raised quietly in other places. Experts describe Kazakhstan and Russia as economically interdependent, sharing infrastructure, mutual investment, and a huge trade turnover of $28 billion. The two countries share the world's second longest land border, almost 5,000 miles, and travel between them is visa-free. Opinion polls show majorities in both countries have a positive attitude toward the other, though feelings for Russia have noticeably cooled in Kazakhstan. In a 2023 poll by MediaNet and PaperLab, nearly one-third of Kazakhs said their perception of Russia has worsened because of the war. In recent years, China has become Kazakhstan's top trading partner, mainly due to sales of oil and raw materials, but Russia remains the country's top security and political partner. I do not see any large-scale competition between Russia and China in Kazakhstan, says Alexander Kinaizev, an expert at the MGIMO University Institute for International Studies in Moscow, which trains Russian diplomats. Moscow and Beijing are capable of maintaining their interests at a mutually acceptable level. Peter Svoik, former deputy chair of the Kazakh opposition Azat Party, says that at least for the time being, the Russian-Kazakh relationship will remain stable. No matter how you look at it, Kazakhstan depends crucially on Russia. The relationship is tight and functions on the level of strategic partnership. But as for the ruling elite, their hearts lie mainly in the West. They understand the necessity of good relations with Russia, but materially and mentally, they are pro-Western. The war in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia have increased Kazakhstan's importance as a provider of oil and other raw materials in Europe, a position that the war's expansion to ports on the Black Sea is now threatening. Other wars in Afghanistan and now Iran have stymied the hopes of Central Asian countries to build southward transport routes that would expand their trading opportunities to the Indian Ocean and beyond. That strengthens their continued dependence on both Russia and China, experts say. So, while Kazakhstan and others might be emboldened, they are also maintaining traditional links and trying to avoid the fallout of war. In the view of Central Asian elites, the world is going crazy, says Mr. Mikhailov. In this situation, the minimum task is to stay out of the geopolitical storm. The maximum is to balance interest, extract benefits where possible, and to stay strong until things normalize. And again, this particular article was by Fred Weir, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. Continuing on in the world section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, Israeli election. As left campaigns, peace with Palestinians seen as a risky proposal. For decades, what distinguished the Israeli left were its calls to negotiate with the Palestinians and for two independent states living in peace. But as it campaigns for national elections, the first since Hamas' October 7, 2023 attack, the peace process is not on the agenda. The date on this article is August the 12th. It is by Shoshana Solomon, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and Dina Kraft, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Tel Aviv, Israel. At the rally in which Israel's new left-wing party, the Democrats, kicked off its election campaign, its leaders called to replace the, quote, rotten, hard-right government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and fed the crowd what it expected from topics that have dominated the headlines. The leaders vowed to reverse the government's efforts to weaken the judiciary, crack down on Jewish terror attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank, and establish a state commission of inquiry into the Hamas-led October 7, 2023 attack, the deadliest day in Israel's history. But at the late June rally in Tel Aviv's Rabin Square, named for the prime minister who was assassinated in a bid to destroy the peace process he helped forge, any mention of peace with the Palestinians was notably absent. While some speakers referred to peace generally, none explicitly said with whom. The omission reflects how profoundly October 7th has hardened the Israeli public's stance on the conflict with the Palestinians. Even the left treads cautiously, wary that outspoken support for Palestinian statehood will alienate voters. Today, the opposition is laser-focused on replacing Mr. Netanyahu, on whose watch the devastating attack on civilians and soldiers took place. The prime minister, fighting for his political survival and keenly aware of the electorate's hardening this week, risked angering U.S. President Donald Trump by rejecting his most recent attempt to revive the moribund Gaza ceasefire. Mr. Netanyahu knows that being seen as giving concessions to Hamas could be fatal to his reelection. He said he would not withdraw from any of the 60% to 70% of the land Israel controls in Gaza until the Palestinian militant group fully disarms. The change in discourse on the political left regarding the Palestinians reflects an accelerated rightward political shift that has been building for years in Israel. The Democrats' leaders are reluctant today to campaign on the issue that once distinguished the left, attempting to negotiate an end to a century of conflict with the Palestinians. While they say the party supports that goal, it's presented as more aspirational than as an immediate objective. Polls reflect the shift in public thought. A June survey by Mitvim, a think tank, found that only 25% of Jewish Israelis support a two-state solution for the conflict, about half the support that existed before October 7th. In a September 2025 Israel Democracy Institute poll, 78% of Jewish respondents said a Palestinian state was not in Israel's national interest. Efrat Tolkowski, a Reichman University lecturer and former member of the Tel Aviv City Council, representing Meretz, a left-wing party that for years ran on a pro-peace platform, exemplifies that shift. It was Meretz that merged with center-left Labor to form the Democrats. Israel's withdrawal from Gaza, for which she fought more than 20 years, failed to hasten the peaceful relation she imagined. Then came October 7th, which moved her views so sharply she won't be voting for the Democrats. A strategy of ongoing violent conflict continues to define the Palestinians, she said. It was not just the trauma of October 7th that changed her outlook, Dr. Tolkowski said, but the growing world antipathy toward Israel in the wake of the Gaza war, in which she feels Israel very legitimately has been called into question. The near flattening of Gaza by Israel, with the accompanying death toll of more than 70,000 Palestinians, both civilians and combatants, has captured world attention. But in Israel, the public lens has remained largely fixed on the devastation of October 7th, when 1,200 people along the Gaza border were killed, most of them civilians in their own homes or young people gunned down at a music festival. If my existence is under discussion, it means that after we leave Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, discussion about Tel Aviv then continues, she says. The two-state vision laid out during the 1993 Oslo Peace Accords had already faded by the early 2000s when Palestinian terror attacks during the Second Intifada squelched hope for many Israelis that peace was possible. The left is now concentrated on trying to change the domestic political scene, so they can't deal at the same time with drawing some new blueprints for the establishment of a Palestinian state, says Tamar Herman, a senior research fellow at the Israel Democracy Institute. Members of the left understand, she argues, that unless they change the domestic scene, this issue will not be discussed in the foreseeable future, and maybe never. Democrats leader Yair Golan said in an interview last year that post-October 7th, to expect Israelis to make the galactic leap from the current situation to a two-state solution is impossible. It's not enough to return to old formulas. We need to adjust our plans, our ideas, our perceptions, he said, advocating instead for a civil separation to lessen the friction between two hostile populations while retaining responsibility for Israel's security. Yet according to Itamar Ivneri, a candidate for a new Jewish Arab political party, Makom Lekulanu, A Place for Us All, neglect of the peace process blew up in our faces on October 7th. It's important to keep reminding both the Israeli and Palestinian publics that no one is going anywhere, argues Mr. Avneri, whose party is polling below the threshold to enter parliament. The only way we can protect ourselves and guarantee safety and security for Israelis and Palestinians is to understand that and to start to talk about how we can live on this land together and how we want to share this land. At the Democrats' Tel Aviv rally, Giselle and Zvi Tal, a couple from southern Israel in matching blue and white Democrats' T-shirts, recount that a relative who was held hostage in Gaza has since returned home. Despite enduring that agony, they say, they remain committed to Palestinian statehood. There are Palestinians who want to talk with us, and together we can have two states for two peoples, Ms. Tal says. The two-state solution is not on the agenda of the upcoming elections for any of the opposition Jewish-Israeli parties, says Mr. Tal. They have had to adapt their message to the mood of the nation to be able to change the government. All the parties have fine-tuned their messages so they can win, he says. Nevertheless, former diplomat and former deputy national security advisor Eran Etzion, who is number 20 on the Democrat slate, insists that peace is high on the agenda of the party. It does distinguish this party from all other political parties, he says. But, he admits, for the average Israeli, the lesson learned from the 2005 disengagement from Gaza is that any territory you evacuate becomes the basis for terrorism. It is understandable why Israelis are skeptical, he says, but it is also the harsh and undeniable reality that unless we separate ourselves from the Palestinians within the context of an agreement, there is no future for a democratic and Jewish majoritarian Israel. That is the winning argument. The message resonates with Yaffa and Moshe Bashar, who came to the rally from northern Israel. The conflict will lead to the destruction of Israel, Mr. Bashar says. We think that even after October 7th, we can talk to Palestinians. They are not all Hamas, he adds, a reference to all Gazans are Hamas, now a catchphrase in Israeli discourse. Images of crowds of Gazan civilians cheering when Israeli hostages were hauled to Gaza on October 7th, and of other civilians taking part in the attacks and looting Israeli homes that day, helped reinforce that view. Sitting on a shady bench during the rally, Or Meyer says she once voted for Meretz. Now she is debating whether to vote for the Democrats or for Gadi Eisenkot, another former general who heads a new centrist party. Many of those killed, burned, and raped on October 7th were for the two-state solution and helped Palestinians and employed them, Ms. Meyer said, but they later came and slaughtered them. The focus of these elections must be, she insists, on how to survive in a region under which we are under threat. Now is not the time to hand over land to them. I'd be happy if there was someone to talk to, she says, echoing a common refrain among Jewish Israelis that there is no Palestinian partner for diplomacy. We want to live in peace, she says, but we also want to survive. Benny Gorer from Tel Aviv was also at the rally. We will change the government and then make sure to create two states for two people, he says. Even after October 7th, there is room to talk. And again, this particular article was written by Shoshana Solomon, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and Dina Kraft, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. And here's one final headline from the World section of today's Monitor for you. It reads, Internet slowdowns and drones in the Strait? Taiwan preps for potential China conflict. Taiwan is finding new ways to ready itself for asymmetrical conflict with China, including disabling the Internet to test civil resilience. The date on this article is August the 11th. It is by Anne Scott Tyson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Taiwan throttled its own Internet during annual defense exercises this week, readying its population for a possible future attack by China. The half-hour drill on Monday in the central city of Taichung, to be repeated Thursday in northern Taiwan and in Taipei, blocked millions of people from using mobile video streaming and other high-data phone functions while the government tested backup communication systems. Air raid sirens sounded as people took shelter in underground parking lots, shops, and basements. The unprecedented test marks a new initiative in Taiwan's efforts to leapfrog ahead in its defensive tactics against China, a much stronger, better resourced potential adversary. Beijing claims the self-governing island of Taiwan as its territory and has vowed to annex it by force if necessary. Taiwan's government asserts the island's de facto sovereignty, and the Taiwanese public overwhelmingly prefers to maintain the status quo of autonomy from China. As China increases pressure on Taiwan, the government is expanding its annual civilian and military defense drills, integrating the exercises for the first time this year. This week's mobile network slowdown is part of a whole-of-society defense effort that aims to prepare everyone, from civilians and local businesses to government and military officials, for a potential conflict. Communications are an important lifeline for national resistance, Premier Cho Jung-tae said last month in preparation for the exercise. The goal is to test extreme scenarios and verify the government's response capability when communications are limited, he said. On the military front, Taiwan is focused on advancing its drone capabilities. This year's war games, which run through August 14th and are the largest ever held on the island, involve drone reconnaissance drills that will help Taiwan track and eliminate advancing Chinese forces in the Taiwan Straits. The exercise underscores how Taiwan's leadership is drawing lessons from other war zones. Looking at the Russia-Ukraine war, the Israeli-Hamas conflict, and even the current U.S.-Iran war, drones are the most important weapons on the battlefield, said Taiwan President Lai Ching-te during a recent visit to the country's Drone Research Institute in Taichung. They are the representative weapons of asymmetric combat power. Taiwan's army commanders say that Ukraine is, in particular, demonstrates how decisive drone warfare can be, assuming their operators are properly trained. Just as soldiers must learn to fire a pistol accurately, drone operators must have proficiency and precision to be effective, says General Liu Kun-siu, while overseeing training this past June. And once again, this particular article was by Ann Scott Tyson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move right along to the USA section of today's Monitor and pick up our first headline, which reads, as financial outlook darkens, colleges cut staff programs ahead of a new school year. Colleges are struggling with financial pressures, forcing them to cut programs and staff. The date on this article is August the 13th. It is by Ira Porter, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Howard University's move to disenroll some 500 first-year students who had not met a tuition payment deadline weeks before the start of the fall semester is bringing renewed attention to colleges' financial challenges and the decisions being taken to address them. Universities are facing a looming drop in enrollment due to declining birth rates, along with a decline in federal funding and the loss of many full tuition paying foreign students who are struggling to get visas. In response, they are cutting faculty and staff, eliminating majors, and pruning electives to control costs. They're also focusing on the income side of the equation, including, as in Howard's case, going after students who fail to pay tuition or meet financial aid deadlines. Howard's interim president, Wayne Frederick, said in a statement that the decision reflected, quote, our responsibility to ensure that students begin their Howard experience with a documented and sustainable financial plan. Without one, they were less likely to complete their degrees, he added. Eventually, the school, based in Washington, D.C., re-enrolled more than 200 of the students they had initially disenrolled. Last week, Howard offered buyout packages to 16% of its faculty and staff, potentially hundreds of employees. The financial challenges are hitting colleges of all sizes and at all levels of selectivity. In April, Syracuse University offered buyouts to about 175 faculty members. The University of Texas at Arlington saw 209 faculty and staff take buyouts in May. Last month, University of Texas at Tyler offered buyouts to nearly a quarter of its work staff. Even schools with billion-dollar endowments are making adjustments. The Harvard Crimson College newspaper reported that dozens of employees have been laid off last week at Harvard University's Faculty of Arts and Sciences. I think we're in a period where a decent number of schools are going to be struggling financially and for a variety of reasons, says Philip Levine, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and an economics professor at Wellesley College. Enrolling students and generating enough revenue to cover their bills is something that many schools need to be concerned about in the coming years. A sharp drop in birth rates in the United States means there will be fewer high school graduates entering college each year, a phenomenon dubbed the enrollment cliff. The applicant pool is already shrinking for some, but not all, schools, and it's creating financial instability. Some tuition-dependent small schools have closed, while other larger schools have announced revenue declines, leading to program cuts and layoffs. Additionally, efforts by the Trump administration to prevent international students from studying in the U.S. has wiped out a source of income, as most foreign students, unlike most Americans, generally pay full tuition. Cuts in federal funding and research have put additional strains on universities. Mr. Levine adds that it's too soon to gauge the impact of the 2025 One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which made significant changes to financial aid. The bill capped federal loans that parents could take out for their children's college education at $20,000 per year or $65,000 for lifetime borrowing. Previously, parents were allowed to borrow the entire amount needed for their children to attend college. Likewise, loans used for graduate and professional schools, which previously had no ceiling on borrowing, were capped at $100,000 lifetime borrowing for non-professional programs and $200,000 for professional programs such as dentistry, medical, or law school. Howard mentioned changes in federal student aid as one of several reasons for employee buyout offers. At HBCU, historically black colleges and universities, 70% of students are eligible for Pell Grants, the federal government's needs-based undergraduate financial program. United Negro College Fund President and CEO Michael Lomax told NPR that both students and colleges are under pressure to meet their financial obligations. The reality is that Howard, just like everybody else, has to pay their bills, and the people who attend the universities have to pay theirs, said Dr. Lomax, who previously served as president of Dillard University and HBCU in New Orleans. Experts say higher education is entering a period of turbulence unlike any it has seen before. In addition to offering buyouts, Syracuse announced that it was cutting 93 of its academic programs, though the school said that was the result of a review of its offerings, not a cost-cutting measure. In July, Temple University laid off about 40 staff members as it tries to address an $85 million budget deficit for the 2026-27 school year. It was the second straight year of layoffs at the school. In 2025, it eliminated 190 positions. School leaders blame steady enrollment decline and a state appropriation that has stayed the same since 2018. The financial strains haven't spared any school, says Professor Levine, but that doesn't mean the pinch will be felt equally across the board. Highly selective and wealthy Ivy League schools will be fine, he says. So will most mid-tier or moderately selective schools like Syracuse. But lower-tier schools and small schools, he predicts, will have difficulty surviving. When Howard disenrolled its students, the school's interim president said the school could no longer afford to let payments slide until students proved that they had the scholarships or grants to cover costs, as it used to do. We have really allowed students to show up without paying us and to carry balances beyond what is appropriate, Dr. Frederick told CNN. That leniency affects retention. Dr. Frederick said that Howard has a four-year graduation rate of 70% and that retention has dipped primarily because of students' inability to pay. Across higher education, students who enroll without a realistic plan to meet their educational expenses are significantly more likely to experience financial hardship, interrupt their studies, or leave college before earning a degree, Dr. Frederick said. We have the responsibility to help students persist, graduate, and thrive. And once again, this particular article was by Ira Porter, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Still on the subject of education, our next headline from the USA section of today's Monitor reads, Finish Degrees for Less. Schools overseas pitch U.S. community college students. Overseas schools offer another path for U.S. community college students to finish their degrees. The date on this article is August the 12th. It is also by Ira Porter, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Unlike her friends and classmates, Sloane Hull didn't want to attend a four-year college after high school. She knew she wanted to be a chef and chose Orange Coast College, a public community college near Los Angeles, for its Culinary Arts Associate's degree. She graduated in December and had planned to transfer to a top U.S. culinary school until she realized the school would not accept her transfer credits, meaning she faced 4 years of about $40,000 as annual tuition. The Transfer Abroad Network, a new business based in California, offered another option. It helps U.S. community college students transfer to international schools to finish bachelor's degrees. Ms. Hull saw a more economical path to a higher degree and the opportunity to study abroad. TAN's founders, Ashley Warmington and Emma Schwartz-Lara, told her about a short summer program at the Business and Hotel Management School in Luzern, Switzerland. There, Ms. Hull cooked with chefs, met students from around the world, and decided to enroll in a fast-track one-year bachelor's degree program. She is scheduled to start school near the end of August. I never really considered going abroad because I just had no idea that my credits could transfer, she said. TAN started in late 2025 and launched with university partners for spring semester 2026. Programs are traditional two-year and one-year bachelor degrees for students who have their associate's degree. TAN's founders said the platform streamlines the transfer process and includes specific transcript information, required classes, GPA requirements, cost, and financial aid information. The National Student Clearinghouse Research Center, which has been tracking a cohort of students who began community college in the fall of 2018, found that fewer than one-third of those students transferred to a four-year school within 6 years. The reasons vary. Curriculum mismatches, as well as unclear transfer rules, prerequisites, and GPA requirements. And the U.S. higher education is among the most expensive in the world. The average tuition, not including room and board, for an in-state public four-year college last year was $11,371 and $25,415 for out-of-state, according to U.S. News and World Report. Private schools average $44,961 per year. TAN identifies schools outside the U.S. that offer accredited degrees as well as those that accept U.S. government financial aid to students. U.S. community college students get a more affordable path to finishing a bachelor's degree, and the schools they partner with gain access to part of the U.S. higher education market. Today, TAN has partnerships with 20 schools in 13 countries, with 11 more schools in the onboarding process. These schools are in countries including Australia, New Zealand, France, Italy, Greece, Japan, the United Arab Emirates, and Spain. Emma and I both worked in international education for so many years. We would be helping students apply to go overseas, and oftentimes there would be so many barriers along the way, says TAN's Ms. Warmington. She and Ms. Schwartz-Lara both studied abroad and later worked as recruiters for international education and study abroad programs in Australia and the United Kingdom. They said that the hiccups to transferring were due to the administrative and admissions process and not students' faults. Universities were just blocked off from connecting with this broader audience of transfer students that had amazing potential, Ms. Warmington says. Ms. Schwartz-Lara adds that TAN knows that there is huge interest in it from the community they serve, but people are unaware of the opportunities and that it's often more affordable than going to school in the United States. There are no official statistics for how many community college students transfer abroad, but experts say the number is small. Only 1 to 2% of U.S. college students study abroad between four-year and community colleges, according to NAFSA, National Association for International Educators. Additionally, only 16% of students who start at community college transfer and finish a degree. It's a big, wide-open field, and there are a lot of community colleges out there, says Beth Thomas, International Officer for the Americas at Abertay University in Scotland, a TAN partner. Not all students will have the option to financially look at going overseas, so I think this will be a game-changer for the right students, she adds. Tan helped schools like hers raise their profile with U.S. students, so it was worth her school paying the annual fee to join the network, she says. Tan said the flat fee does not change with enrollment size, but declined to say how much it is. Ms. Thomas says that in the past, her office would go back and forth with students about the correct materials to send, and now Tan handles that. Aberte accepts U.S. financial aid and offers scholarships to international students. Community college students interest her because she doesn't want to miss non-traditional students who may have started school late or who have families. The biggest dividend is spreading awareness about Aberte. A lot of community college students would think about this, would think this is an opportunity that they can take advantage of, Ms. Thomas says. The more that they can do to raise the awareness to say, this is an option for you, you can do this, you can go overseas, and here's how you do it, that's fantastic. Tara Zirkel, Director of Strategy Research with education consultant firm EAB, says that TAN could appeal to community college students because the pathway is predictable and clear. She says that recent high school grads who are unsure if they want to attend a four-year school abroad could be drawn to the idea of doing community college for 2 years and then going to Australia or the UK. But they need to see that what they want to happen, for example, landing a job, is achievable, Ms. Zirkel said. Guy Bui is the program facilitator at the school's Ms. Hull's Community College in Costa Mesa, California, was the first to work with TAN. Guy Bui is the program facilitator at the school's Global Engagement Center. He wants community college students to have study abroad experiences and to connect with the world in a way that their peers at four-year schools do. We want community college students to be able to have the same access to those types of learning opportunities and experiential personal growth opportunities. So TAN is filling a need that exists, Mr. Bui says. The platform is free for community colleges and students to join. He thinks that more students will begin to take advantage of it. Mr. Bui said that streamlining the process makes it easier for community college administrators and could result in substantial savings for students. That could be the difference between someone transferring it all or stopping at the associate's level, Mr. Bui said. By transferring her community college credits and doing the one-year culinary bachelor's program in Switzerland, Ms. Hull will pay a little more than a quarter of what she would have had to spend over 4 years starting from scratch at a culinary school in New York. She secured housing in Switzerland, got financial aid, and will complete a paid 6-month internship that is built into her program. She hopes one day to be a private chef and own a brunch cafe. I think that going abroad is definitely a big risk to take, and I think that everyone should experience some kind of risk like that and go abroad, Ms. Hull says. I think that community college students deserve the same chance as anybody else. And once again, this particular article was by Ira Porter, who's a staff writer at The Monitor. Still in the USA section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, Parents Push for Less YouTube, More Books in School. Parent groups across the country are pressuring schools to rethink the rapid advancement of technology in the classroom due to concerns over the impact of rising screen time on student development. The date on this article is August the 12th. It is by Stephanie Cook Broadhurst, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and the dateline is Evanston, Illinois. Miriam Kendall has never gotten her children an iPad. She doesn't allow screens at home except for limited TV time. So when her oldest daughter was handed a tablet in kindergarten, it felt like, to her, like opening a Pandora's box. She came home and said, Mommy, you have to let me watch YouTube, recalls the mother of three from Evanston, Illinois. Ms. Kendall, who encourages her children to play outside and not on devices, held the line on her household rule. But when her daughter entered second grade, Ms. Kendall found something concerning when she checked the school tablet's tracker. Her daughter had spent 2 hours watching Taylor Swift videos at school when she should have been learning. She wondered, did the school have a clear policy on technology use? She reached out to other parents who shared her concerns. Today, Ms. Kendall, founder and director of parent group Screen Sense Evanston, is leading the charge in her neighborhood and with others nationwide to unplug kids from devices in classrooms. She speaks at school board meetings and lobbies for screen time limits and a return to pencil and paper learning, particularly in the elementary grades. We want there to be a really thoughtful and strategic reevaluation of the use of technology in schools, Ms. Kendall said. She launched a petition last year to limit screen time that garnered over 1,400 signatures in her local pre-K through 8th grade district of about 6,000 students. This is widespread. Parents are demanding change. Indeed, parents from California to Illinois to Pennsylvania are pushing back against technology they say creates distractions, negatively impacts learning, and conflicts with screen time limits set at home. Many had heeded the advice of Jonathan Haidt's best-selling book, The Anxious Generation, to limit digital exposure, only to find themselves undermined by the place that is supposed to be most attuned to child development, the classroom. How in the world are you providing these highly addictive, highly distracting devices to every single student in the district, said Ms. Kendall, who wants to see clearer policies and more staff training. A decade ago, many districts across the United States raised to close the homework gap and digital divide as educators viewed technology as essential for preparing students for a modern world. They signed multi-year contracts with technology companies and invested billions of dollars into digital tools such as iPads and Chromebooks. In 2020, the pandemic accelerated the trend as districts used federal coronavirus relief fund money to invest in technology and remote learning. When students returned to classrooms, parents had hoped to trade tablets for textbooks as it became clear technology could not replace in-person learning. Today, many school districts have still not fully recovered from historic academic declines in student achievement due to school closures and remote learning, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Nobody stepped back after COVID and took a fresh look at the use case for the iPad and the school policies and said, is this the optimal way to use the tool, says parent Aaron Friedman, of Glenview, Illinois, who launched a petition to limit devices last spring that garnered 1,000 signatures. In spring 2020, about 45% of public schools assigned devices to individual students, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. By the 2024-25 school year, that figure had nearly doubled. Around 88% of public schools had one-to-one computing programs, which provide every student with a school-issued device. Organizers point to growing evidence that shows excessive screen time harms children, including a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services advisory issued in May, linking it to poorer student well-being. Many of these parents helped drive the national Wait Until 8th pledge movement to delay smartphones until 8th grade, which over 155,000 families have signed. They're also mobilizing to support school-wide cell phone bans. At least 37 states now require school districts to ban or restrict student cell phones use during class time, according to Education Week. At school board meetings across the U.S., parents have reported kids playing video games in class and students watching pre-recorded lessons instead of learning from a teacher. Part of the solution, parents say, is to let students dig in the dirt during science class or leaf through a library book during English. Parent Jordan Spickelmeyer from Morton, Illinois, runs a device-free home for her first-grade son and two-year-old daughter. She understands that screens can play a role in learning, but she wonders, are they better than a human teacher? Ms. Spickelmeyer points to how some learning apps are designed to be highly addictive. She's concerned ed tech companies are profiting from children's education and prefers to use paper flashcards with students she tutors instead of quiz apps that often have pop-up ads. Internet Safety Labs, a nonprofit research group, reported in 2022 that 96% of educational apps share children's data with third parties, often unbeknownst to student parents or schools. Educators educators suggest the question isn't whether technology belongs in classrooms, but how it's used. Research shows digital tools can improve literacy and STEM comprehension when used with teacher oversight. A 2024 meta-analysis across 119 studies in the Review of Educational Research looked at EdTech's effects on literacy in K through 5 grades and found positive outcomes for reading comprehension and writing proficiency. But some parents want more say in how their children learn, including the right to remove their students from screen-based instruction. Parents in the Lower Merion School District in Pennsylvania drew national attention in June when yelling broke out at a board meeting after the district repealed a policy that had given families a choice to opt out. Many districts, including Lower Merion, are reexamining their policies. After facing pressure from parents and the group Schools Beyond Screens, the Los Angeles Unified School District in June approved a ban on classroom screen time for students through first grade, while gradually increasing access in higher grade levels. Meanwhile, at least 16 states have introduced or enacted legislation to limit screen time or take a closer look at EdTech policies. Since launching her petition in Evanston, Ms. Kendall said her district has banned YouTube and over 300 non-educational apps from school-issued devices. The district also agreed to screen-free indoor recess, she says. The Evanston Skokie School District 65 did not respond to requests for comments. When Mr. Friedman brought parents' concerns to his school board in Glenview last spring, they listened. Our district takes this very seriously, said Mr. Friedman, who has a third grader. Within a matter of weeks, they came back and instituted meaningful changes, he said, including a decision to review and clarify appropriate use policies for technology in classrooms. Parents agree technology, when properly supervised, can help students conduct research, take online exams, and learn multimedia skills. College student Nadia Easley from Northbrook, Illinois, learned how to type and code in middle school at a private school, Willow Academy. But getting taught by humans is what she remembers most. She grew to love her least favorite subject, history, thanks to a teacher who made the class engaging. A survey of 600 U.S. teachers in May found that 85% believe students spend too much time on screen in class, according to researchers at Auburn University College of Education and Christopher Newport University. It's soft skills that matter most, and those are learned face-to-face with good in-person interaction, says Kim Whitman, a parent from Overland Park, Kansas, an organizer with Distraction-Free Schools Policy Project. Kids coming out of school need to be able to speak to people and look them in the eye. And once again, this particular article was by Stephanie Cook Broadhurst, who is a contributor at The Monitor. And with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you spending some of your time with me, listening to a wide variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with you with more from the Christian Science Monitor next week. Thank you for listening.